Hello and welcome to Pumped, the inside podcast by Schwalbe. I'm your host Tobias Woggon, and I'm talking with Schwalbe athletes from different disciplines, from downhill to cross country, and from road racing to triathlon. Today we're talking to Henrique Avancini. The Brazilian is the first racer of his country who ever stepped on a cross country podium, and even become marathon world champion in 2019. He was supposed to race the Cup Epic together with Manuel Fumig, but the race got cancelled last second. How he got hit by the cancellation and how he's preparing for the restart of the season, you will find out in this episode of Pumped. Henrique, where are you at the moment and how are you?
So I'm pretty good. I can't complain, actually. I'm pretty healthy, close to my family. I'm now in Petrópolis, which is my hometown, about an hour drive outside of Rio, up in the mountains, which is it's one of my favorite places in the world. Actually, it is my favorite place in the world. So. I can't complain to spend some time at home. It's been different and challenging for a few aspects, but I'm having a good time, so happy days.
Yeah, that's great. So as you say, you've grown up close to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and how did you get into mountain biking?
Yeah, so this place, it's quite close to Rio, but it's the lifestyle of the town, it's way more connected to the countryside aspect or to the mountain lifestyle. So it's been always a place where people went to outdoor sports for big hiking, mountain bike riding and stuff like that. And my father was always kind of connected to cycling, so he was a pro cyclist during the 70s, and then after that he worked with agriculture a little bit. And when I was just a kid, about 6-7 years old, he opened a small bike shop, you know, so that was at the beginning of mountain biking, early 90s. And I kind of grew up inside the service shop, you know. So yeah, I was just a freak, man. I was always like reading magazines, reading catalogs. I just loved that environment, and I always liked to see the guys, you know, leaving for training, getting back from training, and speaking about how was the ride and stuff like that. And I just loved this kind of environment, you know. So when I was 8 years old, one of the customers drove into his garage with the bike at the roof of his car, and he just broke the frame in two pieces, you know. So by that time, it wasn't that easy to find materials and stuff, and it was a crumbly frame. And yeah, my old man just got this frame and cut into pieces and made a new small frame to me. And the first mountain bike that I rode was built just from leftovers from this shop, so it was like a little Frankenstein. And from there on, you know, we started like racing. I was always like training. I was hiding from my parents, you know, because I was always like running away from home and exploring the mountains around. And I just love it. That was how I spent my childhood. And this bike, by chance, around two, three years later, after I got it, I was in a race and I missed the turn, and I just rode into like a wall, and I broke the frame again. And I mean, there was nothing we could do. We couldn't repair a second time. So it was 4 years, you know, like just on a corner of the shop. And I think it was pretty lucky, because that was the only reason why I kept my first mountain bike, you know. So I still have this broken frame with me, which is really good to take a look and remember my roots into this sport.
Yeah, it's really funny that you even raced on this bike, which was already broken. So, but how long, how long did it take until you got your first top bike?
Yeah, so my first real bike that I got, I think, was in 2002. It was kind of like the first support that I had from someone. And I got this bike for racing. So that was actually the first bike that I had. You know, the ones before, it was always like from leftovers. At times we were putting something new on the bike, but it was always like, okay, now let's change the frame. Okay, now let's change the wheels. Okay, let's put some clip pedals. So it was always like small steps to have a bike. And the first real bike that I got, like out of a box, was 6 years after I got this first Frankenstein. And that was gold, you know. This first bike was a really nice bike. I remember I was one of the very few riders that was using RockShox City with titanium. With the titanium details, and was just nice, you know, to have the golden details on the shock. And it was a nice bike. It was not a really top end bike, but was on a really good level. I think it was pretty much like LX and XT Shimano, so it was like a nice bike for racing. Yep. And stuff. I still remember the bike. It was really, really nice and beautiful.
So you love Brazil and you love your hometown, but you decided quite early to leave Brazil and move to Italy to become a professional mountain biker. How did it come to this?
So yeah, that was the first try. It didn't come easily, I would say. It was back in 2009. So in 2008, I kind of got my first professional contract. So I was getting some money. I was using the sport to get a purse at the law university. So I was doing half time as a law student and also half time as a pro racer. So what I was managing okay to kind of keep the dream alive, you know, to live out of riding bikes, but it wasn't enough, you know. And by the time the sport wasn't big in my country. And in 2009, you know, I got to the point. I was 19, 20 years old, and the brand that I was riding for got a pretty heavy hit from a crisis that we had that year, and they didn't know if they would continue the team or not for 2009, so they decided to pay the riders Jan and February. And after that, they would decide if they would continue the team or not. So I took those 2 months, the money from those 2 months, and I decided, okay, that's it. You know, that's the push I need. I'm gonna try something in Europe. So I took all the money that I have, and I booked a flight. I made a reservation, and I flew out to Cyprus for 4 weeks of racing at the Cyprus Sunshine Cup, a pretty traditional season opener. And by the time, it was always like there was always good riders racing that, so it was a nice chance to somehow test myself and also to try to find a team maybe. So that's how I went to Europe. But it was pretty funny because I took the decision on a Thursday. I was flying out on a Friday, and I was racing on a Sunday, you know.
And that's a tight schedule.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was purely on emotional impulse, you know. I just thought one day, okay, things are not going the right way, so I need to change, so let's do it. And the next day, actually 2 days later, I was in Europe. But a lot of things happened during this trip. First one was that I I had no credit card by that time, and I flew out with around 200 euros on my pocket. And I made a reservation, you know, on a hotel with full board for the whole period, for the 4 weeks. And my plan was to ride to the races, race, go back to the hotel, and, you know, I would have three meals. I would need to ride from 10 to 60Ks to the races. And yeah, that was the shot that I took, you know. But once I landed, I went to the hotel to check in. The guy said, okay, you have a problem because the reservation didn't accept your credit card. And I did when I was in Brazil using my father's credit card. So it was refused, and then I was in Cyprus with 200 euros on my pocket, and I had to leave for 4 weeks, you know. and then it was pretty critical, you know, because I had to race and to be on top 10, because I just needed to collect some prize money and to survive the next week, you know, the following week. So was pretty crazy, you know. When I look back, I still get a bit shocked, you know, with the situation that I end up, because all of a sudden I was alone in Cyprus. I didn't know anybody by the time, and I didn't know what to do, you know. I the first thing I tried to do was to rebook my flight back home, but I didn't have enough money to pay the penalty to that, you know. So I just realized, okay, I need to survive those 4 weeks here. And by the end of that period, I eventually got a contract, you know. So that's how I end up racing in Europe the next three seasons after that.
That's a pretty cool story, to be honest.
To you, maybe. It wasn't nice to leave that.
Yeah, I think it's better from the outside, definitely. And then you stayed for 3 years in Europe and raced, but then how this first trip come to an end?
Yeah, so when I look back, you know, the idea we get by the time, you know, it's that, okay, the Europeans know how to do that thing, you know, they know how to race mountain bikes. So you need to go there, you need to live their lives, you need to kind of become an European to succeed in mountain bike racing. So that was like the pretty normal way of thinking, you know, and that's what I tried to, the path I tried to follow. So I went to Europe, you know, and then I thought, okay, now I just need to train how the guys train. I just need to eat what the guys eat, you know. I just need to race the same races they are going to, and then I'm gonna measure where I am, you know, or what I can be. But when I look back, you know, I become an average rider. I was kind of alright on few races at times, you know, especially early racing. I was always kind of alright, achieving some good results. But during the main season, you know, during the main events, I was just an average guy, you know. I was never outstanding, and it was that little by little, you know, kind of became something bigger and bigger in my mind. So, and during my last season there, or just before the last season, 2011, I just got a call from my team manager by the time, you know, and he just said, hey, you know what, Avancini, you should kind of rethink about your career, you know, because maybe you don't have what it takes to race at this level. And that was actually true, you know. It was something really hard to listen, but that was the truth. With the level I had at the moment, I was just going to be someone else, you know, in the peloton. And I had like a really big disadvantage, which was coming from Brazil. So even if I was traveling from Brazil to Europe just twice a year, maybe, this added a lot of costs, you know, to a team to have me on board. So when I was in Europe, I had some expenses. When I had to fly from home and back home, that's quite an expensive thing for smaller teams. And And you know, if there was like another guy, which is an European rider, delivering the same level of performance that I was, there was no reason why someone should keep me in the team. So I got to this point, you know, and 2011 was my last year as a under 23 and also my last season in Europe. And I came back to Brazil in 2012 to fight for an Olympic spot, to race the internal criteria to the London Olympics. And during half of the season to July, I had absolutely no sponsor. So I was racing really small regional races, you know, just to grab some small prize monies to make some cash and to pay the trips for the bigger events, you know. So it was really, I was really on the edge of on following a professional career, on being able to keep that or just focus on something else, you know, like finding a job. Or I was getting old. I was already like 23 years old, and I was about to, you know, like just give up racing, because I needed to live, you know. My family needed me, and I wasn't doing any money, and I had no positive perspective, you know, on regarding the sport. So that was pretty much the edge, you know. For a few months I was just about to be forced to not quit, you know, but I had to change my life some way.
Yeah. But now you ended up in one of the professional, if not the professional team in the World Cup Circus. So how did you get back to Europe and into this team?
So yes, I need to go 2 years before that, or 3 years before signing with Cannondale. Because during the time, like mid-2012, I signed with Caloi, a Brazilian brand that was repositioning themselves in the marketing. So they were relaunching high-level products, carbon bikes and stuff like that. And they needed a rider to communicate that. And once I signed with them, you know, I just add a lot of value, because I added some values on the team project afterwards, on product development with the brand, so on communicating. So I was really, really proactive on that. And also besides that, I just took that that call that I received back in 2011, when my team manager said, you don't have what it takes to race on a high level. And I just decided, okay, that's true, and I need to change the way I'm working or the way I'm training. So after that, I just decided, okay, I need to take some deeper risks on training, and I need to do some more than the other guys does, you know. So I tried to dig on every possible area that I could find some performance. And I was just pushing hard on trainings, doing some more sessions, mixing different type of trainings, different type of recovery, different type of diet. So I was really trying to find a better version of myself, on and on. And I took I made a lot of mistakes during this process, because I was always really on the edge. So at times I was over the edge, and I had to take a few steps back and try it again. But eventually, you know, I was stepping up, and then eventually I was riding top 30 on Elite World Cups, and then eventually on top 25. And then the chance appeared to sign with Cannondale. So the Brazilian market was kind of boosting by the time, and Cannondale bought Caloi by the end of 2013. So all of a sudden the Brazilian market became really important to them, and they wanted a Brazilian in their factory team. So that's how I end up racing for Cannondale in 2015. I had an all right level by the time, so I was on top 20. My best world rank was top 15 before I signed with Cannondale. So I was kind of a good rider on international level, but I was nobody that someone would say, okay, this guy, it's gonna be the next big thing. I was actually way, way far from that. And then they gave me a chance. At the beginning, I would say it was really hard, but yeah, that was that was the start of the process, you know, to become a good rider, a top rider.
I watched a video of you packing your things for the World Cup, and you shows which bikes you which books you have with you. One of them is a Bible. So, are you very religious, and does it help you with racing?
I wouldn't say I'm religious, because of the how I see the meaning of that word. But I have a really strong and deep faith in God. So, if I would answer, you know, your question, I would say it's not about how much it helps me on racing, it's how much it helps me on as a human being. So that's how I see, you know. I think in the end, racing, it's what I choose to do. It's actually riding bikes. It has become who I am in a way. So I really live the lifestyle in total. So I'm always quite connected to riding bikes or to the bicycle culture. But I would say, you know, when I take a look, you know, into my history, you know, as a person, as a professional, it's pretty obvious to me to see God in everything, you know. So this how I see it, and I just try to keep that alive in me, to keep this conscious alive in me, and to never forget where I got. And especially how I got to where I am now.
So you had to work a lot to get to the position where you are now. But it still looks like you're super happy on the bike. And you're just not getting tired of getting on your bike every day. Are most racers like this? Or are there a lot of racers who are just doing it for the money or because it's their job?
So the main purpose behind my career, you know, on those days, I see the message that I can share with people, because when you look to my whole history, you know, I was never like an outstanding guy on anything that I did in my life. But I always believe that it doesn't matter how much talent I have, but it does matter how much I'm open to develop the skills I got. Even if they don't look really impressive, you know, at the start. But this is how I face life in general, and especially as a bike racer. And I still see myself the same way, you know. Even if I become like a top rider, number two in the UCI ranking, I finished third in the World Cup last year, and marathon world champion. But to me, this comes like in second place, because in first place, I keep myself open for my personal challenges, you know, and I still see and I understand that I'm not at my best yet. I still fail in so many small things, you know, and I'm still learning how to take the best out of myself. And it's pretty easy, you know, once you start to become successful in the sport, especially on a high level sport environment, you kind of convince yourself about your level, you know. Okay, that's how good I am, and that's it, you know. That's how I do things, and that's it. And you kind of start boosting your ego, you know. And once you do that, you stop trying to find your weak points, you know, where you still have space for improvement. And even on the things that I'm good on those days, I still understand that I still have something to improve, to develop, you know. And that's how I see, you know, that's how I approach my career, and I approach my life in general as well.
Mm-hmm. So you're a very, very powerful rider. You're riding a lot out of the saddle and always all out. And especially on short tracks, you're mega strong. But you're also very good on long distance races. I mean, you just became marathon world champion. But what do you prefer the most?
I like racing. I like racing bikes. I love that. And then, you know what? I think most of the times we tend to put labels on ourselves, you know, and to say, I'm good at that. I'm, you know, I can do this better. I can do that better. And the same way I work, and also I'm always trying to be open to new things. It's also the same way I approach racing. And in the end, I take so much out of different types of racing. And I think that's the main reason why I can do well, you know, at short tracks. I won a couple of World Cups on short tracks. I do fairly well in cross countries. I became a marathon world champion on stage races, you know, like Brazil Ride or Cape Epic. You know, I'm also have some wins and some big results. So I think that's mainly connected to how I see racing, you know. And I just love to be on the start line and to try to understand, you know, how I need to prepare for that race and how I need to extract the best out of my body to deliver myself to a nice result or to the best result I can achieve. And I just refuse, you know, to put labels on myself to say I'm good at marathons, I'm not good at cross country. I just try to see how much I can take out of short track racing in preparation for short track racing and to apply on stage races, on marathon races or cross country races and the other way around, you know. So in the end, I think that I used to say that racing is learning, and I think racing is learning on any circumstance, you know. And once you learn from racing, you can apply on different types of different formats. And I really believe on that, and I think if when I take a look to my career now, you know, I can prove that that makes some sense.
Yeah. So you once said that your biggest goal is to inspire people. Do you have the feeling that you reach a lot more people after you got world champion? Do you have a bigger impact now than before?
Yes, totally, man, totally. Just because my speech before becoming world champion was the same, but it's different, you know. When you start speaking that you believe you're gonna become one of the best, that you believe that you're gonna win big races, and it's beautiful, you know, when you see that confidence or that faith in someone. But it doesn't really make you think about the way you are facing stuff. And once I won the world title, you know, people that were following me for a 1 year, 2, 5 years, or 10 years, you know, the longer they were following me, the hardest was to believe, you know, that I was still stepping up. Because my journey was always like stepping up, but you know, even when I was like, I was stepping up, but one thing it's to step up from top 10, from top 20 to top 10, and then from top 10 to top 5, and then from top 5 to winning. So I never stopped believing that I was going to step up again and again. And I was always speaking that to people, you know, because I was always saying, it's not because I'm special, it's not because I'm talented, but it's just because I keep believing. And I keep working to the things that I believe. And once you get that label, you know, you get that validation that in my case was becoming world champion, and then people just stop, you know, for a moment. And so it happens so often when I'm at the streets, you know, especially in Brazil, that people stop me, you know, and they say, they kind of apologize to me, you know, because they say, before I didn't believe, you know, that you would get that far, and now it's just beautiful to see that you got there, and makes me to rethink, you know, about life in general. And to me, that's when I leave that experience, it's just great, because this it's perhaps the most special thing that I leave on my career. It's the chance to get to this point
what I made people rethink about the way they were facing their lives, the way they were approaching, you know, like their profession and or the sport or personal life. So this started happening more often after I became world champion for sure.
So when you come to the European races, you're a really well-known racer. But in Brazil, you're a real star. So you have your own TV show with more than 3 million people watching. So do you like to being famous in Brazil?
So I always try to don't go the path, you know, that led me into being famous. And I think I did that the right way to this point. So I actually, I'm not that famous in Brazil. I don't consider myself that famous, but I do consider that I have a really loyal fan base. So I think that's a really important difference, you know. So when I got to a point, especially after winning the world champion title, I got the chance, you know, to go to many open TV shows, you know, to speak with millions. And the Brazilians, you know, once you achieve something that never before someone did, so like I was the first guy on this sport to step up on a World Cup podium, then to win a world title. So they get really emotional about that, you know, and they get really proud about that because they understand that it's not easy, you know, to go to a different world and to make your way through. And once you do that, you know, you get a lot of this passionate support. But I just choose, you know, to strengthen myself inside the niche and to strengthen myself inside the outdoor sports niche, you know, or area or environment, as you prefer. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, it's like my TV show. My TV show, it has a pretty good range. We are ranging like, we are going to over 3 million people. But those people, you know, it's like Signet TV and it's a channel of outdoor sports. So we are speaking to people, with people that they have some sort of relation with the sport. And that's the path I try to follow. So yeah, if answering your question, you know, if you ask me if I feel like a famous guy, I'm not. I don't, but I do feel that I have a lot of really strong and loyal fan base behind me, which is good. I think it's even better than being famous.
Definitely. And it gives a good view of mountain biking. So, and it helps mountain biking to grow. Now we have this crazy situation with the coronavirus. When did you hear the first time about coronavirus?
Well, I think it was late in 2019 when things in China started. And then, yes, I had this feeling, okay, it's something is going to happen, you know, at some point. But then we started racing. I started traveling to South Africa. I did my first trip overseas in December for the first training camp, and then the second training camp was early Feb, and then late February I went to Spain to the Copa Catalana in Banyoles, a pretty traditional race. And once I got back from there, you know, I realized, okay, things are still busy, crazy busy in Europe, you know, like normal life, but people are starting to react differently. So I think it's gonna come something like pretty heavy, you know, worldwide. And after that, I went back to Brazil. I had another race with big crowds and stuff like that. And then I flew out to the Cape Epic. During this trip, you know, once I left Brazil, I saw that there was a lot of movement, different movement inside the airport. And once I landed in South Africa, you know, it was also, you know, people like were moving in a different way. So the authorities were kind of preparing themselves for something. Mm-hmm. And then that was just before the Cape Epic, you know, and then the Cape Epic got canceled 2 days know, 1.5 day before the start. And then I just asked the team to fly back home as soon as possible. And then the next day I was on a plane. And once I landed in Brazil, you know, I realized, okay, the first big race got canceled. And now the airport, it's way more controlled. And we're probably going to face something big. And after that, you know, I remember I rang Dixie, the performance manager of Cannondale Factory Racing. And then I just told him, hey, Dixie, I need a week, you know, I need a week off. I always like to do that. I learned to do that. You know, every time I face something that it brings an impact in my life, which is like something like a big win or a big loss or a big frustration or a big change in my life, I just need some time, of a couple of days, maybe 1 or 2 days or a week. I need time to absorb, to understand what's happening, and then I make clear decisions in my head. So I always do that. And then I rang him and I said, Dixie, I need a few days off, you know, because I need to absorb what's going on right now. And then I took a look on some news. I had an idea, you know, what could go related to the season and stuff like that. And then after that, you know, I started dealing super well with the situation. To me, it's not something that it's bothering me or worrying me a little bit. I just take the precautions needed, and I do what I can. I control the things I can, and I just deal with the things I cannot control. So this is how I see myself at the moment.
So 2020 was going to be a very special year for you, because as you said, you were at the Cap Epic, and the plan was to join Manuel Fumek on his last Cap Epic race. And there was a clear goal, it was to win. How hard was the situation when you get the text message that the race was canceled?
So yeah, man, this is actually, I think, it was the hardest news I got during the season, and probably nothing's gonna beat that, you know, in terms of like a professional rider, because there was this emotional piece, you know, behind the Epic that was just massive for me, for Manny, and for the whole crew, you know. So I can't deny, you know, that I felt the heat. Manuel felt the heat, and the whole team got a massive impact, you know, on Cape Epic cancellation. And that was something hard to deal with, you know, because it was his last season, or it was planned to be his last season. And if you tell me if I'm sad that some World Cups got canceled, if Olympics got postponed, World Champs got canceled, all those other races, you know, to me it's just okay to deal with that, you know, because it's like a global situation, and I just plan to be ready to when I'm gonna be able to race again. But in that case, you know, I wasn't sure, you know, I didn't know, or I don't know if it would have us a next chance, you know. So that was the last one, and we were really prepared for that. And once you realized, okay, the last chance, it's not there anymore for you, it's quite something, you know. So I think this frustration, in a way, made me think a lot about life, my career or my personal life or whatever, many other things. But I can't deny, you know, that was one of the biggest frustrations that I had in my career as a bike racer.
So everything gets shifted to next year. Do you think there will be a chance next year for you and Manuel to finally get to race the Cap Epic and win it?
So to be honest, I didn't speak with him yet about that. So we are now around 2 months after everything happened. And I never touched the subject with him, you know, because when I look to Manu, he's a guy that he's on the circuit for 20 years. And he's always been such an ambassador for the sport, and he gave a lot to the sport, you know. And I think at one point, the guy deserves a change in his life. He earned that. So I don't see myself in the position to ask him, you know, hey, you could maybe extend your career another few months, you know, and we could attack the landscape epic together. And I think it's not that easy, you know, it's not an easy decision. And I just hope that he chooses whatever it's better to him, you know, and whatever it makes him happy and satisfied with his life. We had a great run anyway, you know. I would love to win the epic riding with him. I'm pretty sure that he sees the same way. But we had great moments together, you know. So I respect whatever he decides for his future, and I think it's still too early, you know, to make a decision to take a position, and let's see what happens. I think a lot of things comes to place, you know. It was his last contract, so he would need to renew his contract. Olympic year, it's usually the final year of most of the riders' contracts, so I also would need to renew my contract. And there is a lot to be discussed, you know, to be decided. So let's see what the future is going to bring for us individually and also for us as teammates.
So talking about the future, you are very involved into Brazilians mountain biking, and you lead your own team in Brazil. What is about with Brazilian mountain biking? Will we see more riders from Brazil soon in the World Cup?
Yeah, man, you probably will, because the sport now, it's one of the main markets worldwide, and we have a really solid environment for racing, and we have big events, especially on mountain bikes, specifically mountain biking. We have big events, we have a good and strong industry, we have a good media coverage those days. And we have the investment behind the riders. So what happened was the sport that grew up on the last 5-6 years massively. So the money inside the bike industry just raised so much. But the same way that the athletes were getting better support and they could live out of the sport, they were not developing the sportive side of mountain biking. So the racing side wasn't there. The marketing side was always like getting better and better. So we had more media, we had more channels, we had more brands, we had bigger structures, bigger events, bigger crowds. But the sportive level was always like a little bit behind. And right now we are just mixing those two things a bit more, you know. So after I started to perform well on a world level, everyone started to think, okay, it's not that we cannot achieve this level, you know. And once I started to win big races or to set really good results, I got so much attention for myself, but mainly for the sport, that everyone said, okay, this is the way to follow, you know. It's possible to get there. And once you get there, you can do way bigger things for the sport. So everyone's mindset is changing regarding to developing the sport. And I started this project, my own personal project, back in 2015. We started on a lower standard and we step it up year by year. And now we are on a great level. We have a service course. We have a performance center as well, with gym, physio office, you know, with where the mechanics work on the bikes, the warehouse, and it's everything connected. And we have two UCI teams right now under the same structure, which is Cannondale Brazil Race and Caloi team. And it's been great, you know, to work on that side of the sport. So I'm also part of the National Federation Council that set the guidelines for the sport in terms of events, in terms of the development of high-level sports in the country. I'm pretty connected to every race organizer, with people from bike industry in general. So I try to share a bit of my experience, you know, that I got from overseas, and also from the years that I spent with the sport as an athlete and also inside the industry, you know, and I try to put things together in a way that's gonna be good to everyone, to all sides of the balance. And it's good to see, man, that I'm doing that as an individual, you know. So I never turned my back to my personal responsibilities, and now it's just good to see, you know, how far I got inside the development of the sport in my country. It's really, it's perhaps one of the biggest pleasures that I have in my life.
So you're a racer and you really like to race your bike. And when all the Corona stuff is over and racing gets starting again, what is the one you're looking forward to the most?
Oh, I'm just looking forward to get green light. I mean, yeah, I have this thing, you know, that at times, you know, people target too much a certain event, which I don't think it's wrong. Makes sense, actually. But from my side, you know, I like to race, and I like to search the win. And right now, I just hold on getting better. That's my personal goal, you know. So I'm using the time that I have now to train better, to train more, to train, to become more efficient on my way of working. And to be honest, I'm probably on the best shape I ever had in my life, and we are still probably a few months off from racing. But my main goal, you know, once I have the green light, I want to stand in the start line, and I want to know that I'm probably gonna be better than any other race that I did in the past, you know. So that's how I face the situation. And once I get the chance, I just want to race.
Nice. So yeah, thanks a lot for your time. We wish you all the best for all your projects and your training, and yeah, hopefully the racing starts soon again. And yeah, thanks a lot for your time, and talk soon.
Thanks a lot, guys. It was a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed some of the histories and my insights regarding the sport. I hope you like it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers.